Hi, this is Steve. For the last week, I've been studying Mel Gibson's 1995 Academy Award-winning film, Braveheart. I've waded through fight choreography and period costumes, use of slow motion, locations, film scoring, and sound design. But this film has also led me to study the real lives of William Wallace, Robert the Bruce, King Edward I of England, and their battles over the independence of Scotland, which in turn has led me to the modern Scottish independence movement and its connections to Ireland, Brexit, and European politics. In other words, as so often happens in my preparation for the Cinephiles, a single film has led me down a crazy rabbit hole that will only end when John and I get together tomorrow night to record the actual episode. And of course, it's talking to John and hearing his thoughts about the film, which is actually the fun part. You see, all I really know right now is that he loves the movie, but how that love manifests itself in his life and his way of looking at the world is, until tomorrow night, a complete mystery to me. Braveheart is an extremely popular film and among our most requested on Patreon, but if you haven't actually seen it, you might want to visit cinephiles.net, where you can go down your own rabbit hole by buying or streaming every film we've ever reviewed. When you're done with that, you can come back on Friday to hear how our conversation went on part one of Braveheart, only on The Cinephiles.
I'm dying in your beds many years from now. Would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom!
Welcome once again to The Cinephiles, where each week we enter the world of a great film. We explore its themes, the history, the filmmaking, and the influence it has on us today. My name is Steve Morris, and I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, everyone. My name is John Rocha. I'm a voiceover artist, writer, host, and producer over there at Collider Video, and co-host of the Top 10 show, which is now on its own feed, just letting you all know. A big plug there. Some of you have been trying to find it under the Schmozno feed. It's no longer under the Schmozno feed. It's on its own feed. Go to wherever you get your podcast. Type in the top 10 with the number 10. We should come up and sign up and subscribe. So if you've been missing episodes, that's why you've been missing episodes. Matt and I are really excited to be branching out on our own.
And for all of your top 10 or Cinephiles needs, you should be following John Rocha at The Rocha Says.
Please.
And Matt Nost, it's at Matt Nost.
At right? Matt Nost, yeah.
And then follow me at SR Morris, and absolutely, you will get this information.
That's right. That's
and you
right.
won't have to wait to find out or lose your feed. This is important stuff.
Yes, very important stuff.
Also important stuff is that today on The Cinephiles, mm-hmm. we are covering what is one among our most requested films ever.
Yeah.
And that is 1995's Braveheart.
Yeah.
It's a lot of emotion.
Freedom!
Some powerful stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very powerful for our patron members. This is, they're not one, not two, not three, not four, but five patrons requested this. They are James Kang, Laura Deverson, Rod Harris, Rodrigo Picardo, and the Blast from the Past podcast has also requested this.
Thank you.
That's right. We have a podcast that is supporting another podcast.
Gotta love that.
That is great. So first of all, we would love to hear what all these people, why all these people wanted to recommend Braveheart. And then also go listen to the Blast from the Past podcast.
Yes.
Hey, guys. This is James from San Francisco. Braveheart has always been one of my favorite films of all time because it had everything I was looking for growing up loving film. Violence, themes about loyalty, revenge, and betrayal, and the speech from William Wallace is often what I hearken back to whenever I need to motivate myself to live life never having regrets. Thank you for covering this film and digging into its themes. Really looking forward to it.
Hi guys, this is John from Las Vegas. I just wanted to let you know how excited I am that y'all are going to be reviewing one of my favorite movies of all time, Braveheart. I'm particularly looking forward to you breaking down all the little details that make this film so great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, everyone. We really appreciate your support, and we love hearing your voices on our show.
Absolutely. So many different points of views and so many honest points. I love listening to these on the episodes because people have such honest takes on these films, how much they love them and why they're moved by them. And sometimes they're apologetic almost in certain ones, and you're like, don't ever apologize for loving a movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whatever your reason is for loving a movie, that's why it was created, for you to love it.
Wow, I love that.
I'm just saying. Yeah.
That's great. John, do you remember how you first came to Braveheart?
Oh, yeah. What's this? 95. So certainly this is back in that time where I'm coming out of, where I'm like kind of figuring out what I'm going to do with my life. I know that I'm in the military at the time, and I go to, and I know I'm in love with movies, and I go to see movies all the time by myself. This is during that period where I would go by myself. And I think I remember seeing this one with a friend of mine late at night. It might have been my friend Clay. And we went to go see it at one of the 7 o'clock or 9 o'clock screenings and just blown away by it. Just absolutely blown away by it. And at the time, I'm a massive Mel Gibson fan because of Lethal Weapon and everything else. Enjoying. So to see him take this on and, you know, direct it and act in it, star in it. And what a moving film. And I remember hating the English. I just remember throughout the whole movie, it really makes you hate the English.
It's very powerful in that way.
Yes, yeah, so much. And by the end of the movie, you know, I was inspired by it in so many ways. It's one of these films I come back to because it is about the underdog overcoming and somehow for something bigger, a purpose bigger than themselves.
Freedom.
Exactly.
So I've been very excited to tell this story because for me, this is my first star-studded movie that I saw.
Oh.
Because it's 95. It was my first year in film school. Mm-hmm. And I think it was my friend Jeremy at film school, who you know.
Okay.
He somehow had a connection at Paramount.
Oh, right.
And we went to, this is long before the DVD business.
Yes.
This is just at film school. And we went on the Paramount lot,
yes.
Karen and me, and I think it was Jeremy, and we went to that main theater on that lot, which is really nice.
Yeah.
And we're sitting down, and there at that movie theater is Mel Gibson and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Whoa.
And Maria Shriver and a whole bunch of other stars, because this is like 2 months before it was released, and it's the first like big screening.
Wow.
And I don't know why I was there. It was gorier and longer than what we've seen.
Oh.
And I just blew me away.
There's a longer version of Braveheart.
Well, it's an earlier cut.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was just like, it would have been amazing anyway.
Right.
But amazing, and knowing that Mel Gibson is like up there behind me,
mm-hmm.
it was crazy. Yeah.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it was awesome.
And we had a friend who became assistant to Mel Gibson for a while, right? At Skydance. Yeah.
Yeah. So a little pre-production. Of course, this starts with Randall Wallace. And Randall Wallace is the screenwriter and mm-hmm. may or may not be related to William Wallace. There's these legends that maybe he is. I think
sure.
he probably isn't. Here's what he says. He says that he had no real sense of his Scottish heritage at all. And it wasn't until his wife became pregnant with her first son that he went, I really should find out about, you know, who I am and where I come from so I could pass it on to my son. So they took a trip to Scotland, and he's at Edinburgh Castle. And there at the castle, there are two huge statues, one of William Wallace and one of Robert the Bruce. And he says, talking to a guard who's right there, wow, they must have been amazing allies. And the guard said, well, maybe. I can't do a Scottish accent.
Yeah,
I'm not going to try. And he said, there's a rumor that Robert the Bruce betrayed William Wallace.
Oh.
And he goes, huh. And that is the kernel of the idea that led to everything else. The idea that Robert the Bruce might have betrayed William Wallace. And here's the interesting thing about Randall Wallace. Mm-hmm. His philosophy is to write first, research later. And it's going to show in this film in a lot of ways. And there's some spectacularly good writing here.
Yes, there is.
Amazing writing.
It won an Oscar. It must have had great writing.
There's some things that maybe aren't so accurate. And we are going to kind of have to discuss some of those.
Steve, I spent 2 hours watching videos about how historically inaccurate this film is. And you know what? It still doesn't diminish my love for it.
I love this movie.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. I mean, we're going to have to talk about it because I don't think we can do Braveheart and not discuss it.
Absolutely.
But I still love this movie.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes to write it. And the big idea, what he said, is that he believed that our job was to be myth makers,
mm-hmm.
not to be historians. You can go to a historian to get a historian. And the big source he gets this from, I mean, there really was a William Wallace, mm-hmm. but there's not that much information about him.
Mm-hmm.
And the big source he goes to is a guy named Blind Harry.
Yes.
And Blind Harry writes an epic poem of William Wallace. Mm-hmm. He writes it about 100 years after William Wallace's death.
Yeah.
And probably didn't base it on very many historical accounts at all. And he writes the screenplay. It's bought by Alan Ladd Jr., who's one of the great producers who we've actually talked about on the show before. I think we talked about him with Blade Runner and a bunch of other things. And they send it off to Mel Gibson. Mel passes.
Interesting.
But can't get it out of his head. A couple of months go by. Randall Wallace gets the call from his agent that we all want to get, which starts with, "Are you sitting down?" I was like, has anyone ever said this to you?
No.
I can't imagine what the response is, because he's like, "No, I'm not sitting down." He's like, "Well, you should sit down." He's like, "I don't have a chair." What's going on? And he says, "Mel Gibson wants to meet you."
Oof.
So this is what he says, and I actually think this is great, is he thinks to himself the day before the meeting, or when he's going, he says he literally prayed to God and said, "Please don't let me kiss his ass. Wow. Please, God, don't let me kiss his ass." Because what he said, and I think this is 100% right, is when you get in the room with these people that have the power to make your dreams come true, essentially, you really want to do anything you can to get them to like you and say yes to you. And so the instinct is to say, please, please, please. And he doesn't want to do that. So he goes and meets with Mel. And he basically, it sounds like, the meeting starts and he says, hold on a minute. I need to say something. And he says, this is a movie about this. And it is about these. This is its theme. This is what it's about. This is what it's for. If you are interested in making that kind of movie, great. If you want to make any other kind of movie, let's just stop this right here because life's too short.
Wow.
And Mel goes, yes. Sells it in the room.
Wow. That's awesome.
Of course, this is from the guy who doesn't give a very accurate version of William Wallace.
That's true.
Is this story true? I don't know, but I like it. And that, I believe, is all I have in pre-production at this moment.
Okay.
Would you like to get into the movie?
Yeah, let's do it.
We start and we see that title in the fog and we hear that music with the bagpipes. James Horner.
Great score.
It is fantastic.
Yeah.
It's an amazing, powerful, moving score.
Can I say one thing here?
Yes.
When I won my title recently for the Schmodown, this soundtrack is what I would meditate to before I came out to perform, compete.
The Outlaw had to go to Braveheart level of intensity.
I had to feel like an underdog walking in amongst the British. I had to feel like a hero to go against, it's stupid, I know it's stupid, to go against Ben Bateman, Andrew Guy, and then ultimately to beat Bibbiani for the title. I had to feel like, so the music got me into that place of feeling like the underdog, having to fight to the end.
I've heard you talk about this music for the Schmodown before.
Yeah.
I think the story of the soundtracks of each of your battles would be really interesting.
That's fair. That's fair.
And then we hear voiceover.
Yeah.
Which later we find out actually is Robert the Bruce. Mm-hmm. And he says,
"I shall tell you of William Wallace. Historians from England will say I am a liar, but history is written by those who have hanged heroes."
Okay, when you write a movie that is historically inaccurate, you have the first line I know historians are going to call us a liar, but those people are evil. it's very clear they knew that this was not going to be accurate.
And it's ironic because it's the death of the king, and the king actually doesn't die for another 4 years. Six years from where they say 1290, it's actually 6 years later that the king dies.
Yeah, so
it's really weird how they make it all fit.
Well, and what's funny about it is like switching the death of the king from 1280 to 1286, the whole way that the movie is structured is based on this timeline, which isn't real.
Right.
Which is that, because the way, and we'll talk about this as we go along, is that William Wallace talks about this thing we've never had, freedom.
Yeah.
Because the implication is we've been impressed, not just for our lifetimes, but for generations by the English. Yeah. That is not true at all.
Right.
There are things where there are matters of opinion, but the year the king died is not a matter of opinion. That's just a straight up fact. He died at this time. But yes, they say that the king died in 1280.
Yeah.
And we hear that evil Edward Longshanks, who was a pagan, not a pagan. I mean, he's evil.
He's evil.
He's not a nice guy.
Right, right.
But he was not a pagan, and that he had claimed Scotland, which he had not.
Right.
Not at this time. And that there were all these battles going on. There were no battles going on with Longshanks at this time. And that there was these lords invited to this truce. They each could take one page. This didn't happen. and Malcolm Wallace, a commoner with two sons, John and William. We meet them, and they're working their fields.
Yep.
William Wallace was not a commoner.
He was not.
He was a minor nobility.
Yeah, he was the son of a knight.
Yeah, not a commoner.
Not a commoner. Certainly was down in the dirt.
And yet, is the movie working on you?
Absolutely.
100%.
Once again, I'm in.
Yeah. I'm totally in.
For the American audience, is this idea of a self-made man.
Yes.
This is very important. It totally hooks into you as an audience. You go, oh, yeah, I can be that.
Yeah.
I can be that.
Totally.
And that's why the movie works well.
I hadn't thought about it until you said that, but Mel Gibson has this interesting history as this guy who was born in the U.S.,
yeah,
raised in Australia,
right,
has connection to Scotland through his family, mm-hmm, and then comes back to the U.S. He has these multiple identities, mm-hmm, many of which are not fans of the English.
Yeah, right.
It seems like this really fits into his self-madeness, mm-hmm, you know?
Plus, he's a big fan of vengeance films.
A little bit. Not to, we could throw in a bit of torture and
yeah.
And violence and gore. Mm-hmm. I think that the design of this era, particularly the poor Scottish people, mm-hmm, is unlike anything we've ever seen before. And while there are many inaccuracies in this movie, the fact that everyone is dirty and living in stone and, right, you know, that's much more accurate than seeing a bunch of guys in felts and doublets, yeah, and things like that, which were with matching colors and everyone very clean. That's not so right.
Right. And why would you care about a person of nobility wanting to, you know, create or wanting to fight for freedom? Why would you care? You have to make it seem like it could be.
Well, throughout history, we have cared about people of nobility. You know, King Arthur and Robin Hood are both examples,
sure,
of people of nobility fighting for that.
Sure.
But so we do, but I'm kind of with you.
Yeah.
I mean, I care. You know, this version of William Wallace, I'm sold.
Yeah.
And his dad and his older brother going off to do something, and they say, no, you can't come with us. And they head off to this meeting place where, mm-hmm, these lords and these kids have gone, and something is a little creepy, and they hear a horse whinny, and they start calling out their names, and they enter the house holding a pitchfork, and everyone is hanging from the rafters.
Yeah.
Really creepy and scary.
Mm-hmm.
And those were a bunch of real dudes hanging from the ceiling.
Oh, wow.
And they were hanging all day.
Damn.
Every 30 minutes, they took them down for a tea break and then back up.
Wow.
Making movies is weird.
No, that's like, that's so strange.
But there's a real, well, and you could tell by the weight and the way they move.
Yeah.
And they hear something and they turn and there is young William Wallace. Yeah. Looking in at the bodies.
Young, blue-eyed, mulleted William Wallace.
That kid is great casting.
He is.
He apparently had only acted in school plays. This is what I've heard before this. He's just perfect. William Wallace is asleep, and then he has this dream where this kid turns to him and says, the kid hanging from the rafters turns and says his name. There are a couple of these dream moments that are really interesting in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he wakes up and he hears his father arguing about whether or not we're going to war, essentially. Mm-hmm. And the first thing is like, well, look, every person who was ready to fight, they were at that meeting. They're all dead. Right. Edward the Longshanks wiped them all out, which he didn't.
Right.
Well,
not at all.
No, nothing.
This meeting even never happened.
Nothing happened. Yeah. Well, Edward Longshanks had nothing to do with Scotland. He was, there was a king who was still alive.
Yeah,
there was
right.
no war going on.
That's a good point.
Yeah. And finally, they agree to fight, and we see Daddy pulls the sword hidden out of the thatched roof, and William's already on the horse because he wants to go fight.
Right.
And a good help you'd be, too. But I need you to stay here and look after the place for me while I'm away.
Which is sort of from our modern perspective, mm-hmm, the idea, oh, we're going to leave this 9-year-old kid just in the middle of nowhere to watch the land, but that was normal. And he says, I can fight.
I know. I know you can fight. But it's our wits that make us men.
This is a classic theme that goes throughout this whole film that I love. And the brother kind of cuffs him and they mount up and they ride off and there's distant thunder and beautiful scenery, which we're going to see throughout this whole film. I mean, incredible, magnificent scenery.
Yeah.
And then we see that British soldiers have arrived now in William's area, which they hadn't, because mm-hmm, they weren't here yet. And we meet young Hamish.
Yes.
And there's this very cool moment where they're kind of going, look, the British are here. We're going to have to fight them ourselves. And they grab rocks and you go like, oh my God, are they going to attack British soldiers? But no, they're just imagining it and they throw some rocks at a thing.
Right.
And then And William, of course, is the better rock thrower. And Hamish responds?
With a punch in the mouth.
Punches him in the mouth.
Yeah.
These Scottish people, they like to punch their friends in the mouth a lot.
They're tough people.
They're tough people.
Not really good with emotions.
Yeah. And now it's twilight and he's all alone and he looks off into the distance. And then it's morning and he gets up and he's making a fire and he's getting some water and he's doing the stuff you got to do. And then he sees some men coming in the distance.
Yeah.
And at first he's excited because it must be his dad and his brother. And then he sees that it's a cart and he knows.
Yeah.
He knows right away. And the shots are beautifully composed. Mm-hmm. William in the foreground, the cart coming in the background. We see Hamish's father, which is, his name is Campbell, and that's James Cosmo.
Yeah.
I love him in this movie.
Everything he shows up in,
he's every great. Moment in this film, he's great. And you're right. Everything he shows up in, he's great.
Yeah.
He's a fantastic actor.
He was in Game of Thrones for a season or two as
Who
well.
Who was he in Game of Thrones?
He was, on the Night's Watch. He was one of the guys who was on.
Is he Mormont?
He is Mormont. Yes, he is Jorah's dad.
Holy shit.
Yeah, that's James
Cosmo. I literally just watched him. I didn't. Now that you say it, of course that's who that is.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I can't believe I didn't notice him. And later on, they've kind of laid out the bodies in the house, which is how they used to do it. And they're cleaning the bodies. And he starts to reach out to touch his father's body, and he can't quite do it.
Yeah.
We're at the funeral. They're wrapped in shrouds. The service is being given in Latin.
Yeah.
And we see this little girl looking at William Wallace. And everyone, you know, we kind of finish the service. Everyone crosses themselves. And Hamish, with an affectionate pat on the back, walks away. Mm-hmm. And the little girl kind of turns to him like she wants to go to him. But then Mom takes her by the hand and starts to take her away. And William is just standing there alone at the graveside looking at the bodies. And the girl gets away from Mom. She plucks a flower. And just in beautiful slow-mo, which we're going to see throughout this film, hands the flower, and we hear for the first time the love theme, the beautiful love theme of this film. And the kid cries, and it's really good kid acting from both him and the little girl.
Absolutely. By the way, that didn't happen either. The little girl didn't take the flower and give it to him.
Well,
it's historically inaccurate.
His father didn't die at this time. His father died much later.
He was already a young man when his father died.
He was like 16 or 17 when his dad died. But I think you make a good point.
Oh, Randall.
The flower is a purple thistle, which is the national flower of Scotland.
Right.
So this is where I do like Randall's writing. And I want to talk about how he did this.
Sure.
Because this relates. This is how I experience writing a lot,
mm-hmm.
which is that, so he needs to write this. First of all, he chose not to write the grown-up stuff because he was scared of it. So he decided to write William Wallace as a kid.
Oh, wow.
Fear is a great motivator when you're writing. Like, I don't know how to do that. I will go do this.
Right.
And then as he's writing this, he gets to the funeral and he went, well, how does it feel to be at a funeral? And he remembered going to this funeral of a friend of his who's a family member had died.
Mm-hmm.
And he's looking, remember his friend being alone, you know, at this funeral of his, I think it was one of his parents. And he thought, man, how lonely this guy must feel. And it was the feeling of remembering his friend's loneliness that he gave to William as he's standing alone by the graveside.
Right.
And then as he was thinking about it, he just felt so bad for the character of William that he wished someone could do something nice. And that idea of imagining his friend and imagining William and imagining the loneliness led to the idea of the girl picking the flower and giving him the flower. And that's all he knew about that. He didn't know that this girl would ever come back in the movie.
Right.
This is just because that was how to solve the problem of that moment.
Mm-hmm.
After the girl goes away, a beautifully dressed man comes up, and that is Argyle.
Uncle Argyle.
Brian Cox.
Yeah.
Again, great, great casting.
Crazy eye of his.
Yeah, it's really, yeah. Creepy and fascinating, I think. And later on, Argyle's talking to William and says, you're going to stay here tonight, and then tomorrow you're going to come home with me. And William says, I don't want to go. And he says, you didn't want your father and brother to die either, but it's happened. Argyle's not soft.
No, no, no.
Exactly. Then again, we're in this weird dream moment where he's lying on the bed next to the body of his dead father on the slab, essentially. Yeah. And his father turns his head and looks at him and says,
your heart is free. Have the courage to follow it.
They made up that line on the set.
Wow.
Yeah, they're just like, he should say something.
Yeah.
And that's what they made up.
just nice.
It's a nice line because, yeah, you are now no longer beholden to the family. You can go and be whoever you want to be.
Whoever you want to be.
Right.
Yeah.
You owe nothing to us. We are gone now.
Well, this is, I mean, in a weird way, this is so linked into, you said it so right. I hadn't thought about it, but linked into like American tradition, because this is, this is Batman.
Yeah.
This is, you know, your father, your parents have been killed.
Right.
And now you get to be who you get to create a new identity.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And he hears bagpipes. And he comes outside and he sees these players playing in the moonlight. And it is beautifully filmed, as everything in this film is. And Argyle's there, and William asks what he's doing. And Argyle says,
saying goodbye in their own way. Playing outlawed tunes on outlawed pipes. It was the same for me and your daddy when our father was killed.
And there's a look between them, and they share this moment. The idea that, like, oh, my father experienced this thing. And the relationship of their death to England and to the oppression of Scotland.
Yeah.
And the relationship of the outlawed bagpipes to the oppression of England and the oppression of Scotland. And even the relationship to William Wallace having, or to his dad having to hide his sword in the thatch roof.
Yeah.
All of this is setting to this theme that is so important. And of course, A, those aren't Scottish bagpipes. They're Irish bagpipes.
Oh.
And B, there were no bagpipes at this time.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
C, they weren't outlawed.
And they weren't outlawed.
They didn't exist.
They didn't exist, right?
Bagpipes are like 100 years later.
Yeah, but it's such a brilliant way to lay the groundwork exposition-wise of this evil force in the in his world, which is the British, the English.
The English.
This is why I will always hate the English. In his mind, I will, oh, because they took my father from me. They tried to subjugate us. They tried to do whatever, blah, blah, blah. I also want to say this, and we'll get to it, I know, in a little bit, but Randall's decision to use Uncle Argyle as a convention in order to have a more intelligent, educated, knowledgeable Wallace, while still being a quote-unquote commoner, he is unusual for the commoners. Why is that?
Because he had this experience with this educated man.
Exactly. Who taught him Latin, took him to Europe, taught him how to fight, all this jazz, taught him to use his head over before he uses a weapon. All of this, I think, is Randall's way of kind of roundabout way of you in the, using the actual history of William Wallace and kind of putting it into the story in his own way to make it work in this construct of the story. Because he was educated. He learned how to fight at a very young age. He was a knowledgeable man of letters. So it's like he knew what he was. He wasn't some idiot, you know. He was a man who was conditioned or trained from birth to be a certain level of nobility.
Well, that's what's so, and there's rumors too. And by the way, so the documentation on the actual William Wallace is fairly thin.
Yes.
And I've looked into it, you know, as much as I could in a week. but there's even a thing that he might have been a mercenary at some point.
For the king.
For England, Edward. Edward.
Yeah.
There's speculation about that. And it has to do with the emblem on a certain weapon or.
Yeah, it's an archer.
An archer. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's what it was. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, very good. So they go off. And now we go to England.
Yeah.
And we hear that it's many years later, and Edward the Longshanks, he's supervising the wedding of his eldest son. And the son is nervous.
Yes.
And we find out that the bride is the daughter of France, who is Isabella. And there's kind of looks to dad. The son looks to dad, looks at his bride, and looks to this very striking man in the crowd.
Very good looking man.
A very good looking man.
Yes.
And dad sees that look. He doesn't like it. And we hear from the narrator.
It was widely whispered that for the princess to conceive, Longshanks would have to do the honors himself. That may have been what he had in mind all along.
And the son kisses the bride on the cheek. And this is the first of our introduction to the gay prince.
Yes.
And there are some feelings about the way that this is handled.
Yes.
And, you know, we'll get into it as we go along.
Sure.
But I should point out, I have no problem whatsoever with a character hating his son because that son is gay.
Yes.
That happens in real life. Yep. And maybe even happened between Edward the Longshanks and Edward II, as there is rumors of his homosexuality.
Yes.
Not
son was possibly
was homosexual. Possibly gay.
There are historical documents that show his affinity for his male friends and giving them lands and titles when they were not noble in any way, shape, or form, and he enjoyed the pleasure of their company with intimate relationships with them, whether it means sex or homosexuality, who knows?
Yeah. The treatment of this, which is often treated as a joke, as a punchline, is at times distasteful to me in this film.
I can understand that, but the person doing it is evil. So he's supposed to do bad things.
I have no problem with that character doing bad things.
Right.
And this is something we talked about, this come up over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Is that it is, and this is the ultimate example of it, and I'm glad we finally gotten here, which is the difference between having a character who makes certain choices or has certain opinions and having the opinions of the filmmaker revealed in the character's choices.
Yeah.
Is that I believe that those are filmed for comedy. Mm-hmm. And that they are filmed so that you, particularly when we get to where he throws the guy out the window, that is not, it's not the action of the character. Mm-hmm. It's the way it was filmed. And I think this is the filmmaker's feelings coming through in a way that I really don't like.
I think that's fair, Steve. Absolutely. And he's turned the prince into an effeminate character, an incompetent character because he's effeminate, indirectly because he's gay. And so, that's there.
And
uses a punchline throughout. Absolutely right. The dad is disappointed in him.
Right.
And you're right. And Gibson must take responsibility for this. And to be fair, in 95, this played well for a lot of people.
I saw it in the theater at the time that I said. I saw it later on in the theater again. Big laughs.
Yep.
Big laughs.
Yep.
Well, and this is where, look, I don't know that we're going to get into Mr. Gibson and his personal life and his personal beliefs, and maybe we will at the end. I don't know. I think he's a fine director.
Yes.
I think he's even with movies, like Passion of the Christ, I don't understand why he wanted to make that particular movie that particular way.
Right.
I think that is a beautifully crafted movie.
Agreed. Apocalypto as well. Apocalypto is one of the most
Apocalypto better.
Adventure films or chase films ever.
I mean, he likes things really violent.
He does.
And he doesn't care that much about dialogue, as we know in those movies, because we don't understand any of it.
Right.
But he's a real director, and I really admire his skill. While there might be things about some of his choices in personal life, maybe I'm not such a fan of.
That's fair.
But anyway, we're at the end of this wedding, and we have to again point out the timeline.
Yes.
Which is that... So the William Wallace Rebellion starts around 1296.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is getting pretty close to that. So the latest this could be is 1295, 1296.
Sure.
That's the latest.
Right.
Isabella was born in 1295. So she was at the oldest at this time, too.
Well, I hear multiple different things. I hear she was 9.
And she was 9 when he died.
And then 13. So I've heard these multiple ages.
So she was 9. So she was born in 1295. This is like,
this is history.
Confident on that timeline.
Okay.
Exactly when this moment is, we're not exactly sure.
Right.
But, he died in 1304. So she was 9 when he died.
Gotcha.
And she was 13 when she got married. And she was 16 or 17 when she had her kid.
Right.
So anything having to do with Isabella is not in the movie.
Listen, personally, it's always been the one thing that I didn't like about the movie, or they kind of bothered me about the movie, because it's all built on this relationship with Mara and what happens to Mara. To have him then later on in the movie sleep with this woman drove me nuts, because I'm like, if this is done out of love and blah, 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 the love must stay eternal for you to like sleep with the, prince's wife or whatever. And it just didn't make sense to me.
It goes into like the love story with Mara is so great.
It's fantastic.
It's so beautifully done. Is that this one seems, I totally understand why Isabella might be in love with this romantic figure.
Sure.
But the fact that they would consummate it seems like I don't get it.
It's a bridge too far for me in the movie. It's always been a bridge too
far. Well, I mean, here's, and this is maybe spoiling a little bit of my feelings about the film. I think when we're in Mel's story,
yeah,
this movie is amazing.
It hums along fantastically.
And yes, when we go to England, or when we go to Robert the Bruce and his leopard father,
yeah,
it's like it was made by a different person.
It feels conventional.
Yeah, it's like, oh, now we're kind of advancing the story, and here's the bad guy, and here's this. And then you're with Mel and Hamish, and you're like, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing film. Yeah. And so, it's strange to me. It's conventional. That's the right word. You said it exactly right.
Yeah.
Okay, but doesn't matter. We're going to continue to explain some of the inaccuracies, but we're also going to continue on the film.
Yeah.
And later on, we're still with Edward Longshanks, and he's talking about our problem with the Scots is messing up our relations with the French, because they're not going to respect us because we can't, you know, kick their ass as we're trying to do, which they weren't. Mm-hmm. And in comes Isabella. And the first thing is, where's my son? And she said, oh, he sent me in his stead. And Longshanks' response is, well, I guess if you're going to rule, you might as well stay.
Yeah.
Which is very liberated of him on some level. And now we get into this idea that the nobles are really the key to Scotland, and we're going to give them all lands and estates to kind of bribe them to be on our side.
Right.
Certainly that's stuff that was 100% going on.
Yeah.
And then he says, as he looks at the princess, the trouble with Scotland is it's full of Scots.
Scots. This line is, this film is eminently quotable.
Totally.
I mean, there's so many great lines in this movie.
I should give more of the quoting to you, because you could do the accent.
Well, the actor is incredible.
He's great.
Yeah, who plays Longshanks. He's such a perfect villain.
And speaking of villainous, he is about to suggest a new idea that is so horrible, which is this idea of prima nocta.
Right.
Or there's a bunch of different ways to say it. It's from Latin. And the basic idea is that the Lord gets to have sex with a woman on her wedding night.
Oh, the Lord of that particular land.
That particular land.
He has the choice. He has the option to have sex. I don't know where this came up. I don't know who created this damn thing. But from what I read in some of the reviews of this, some of the historical, this is not historically accurate at all.
No.
No one ever proposed.
Not only did this not happen at this time, there's very little evidence that it's ever happened on a wide scale. Not that lords didn't rape women.
Of course.
I mean, a lot of horrible things that went on in the world. But as a policy that on your wedding night, the Lord is going to come do this, it's not a real thing.
Right.
You know, but he's suggesting it. And his line is, if we can't get them out, we breed them out.
If we can't get them out, we'll breed them out. I love that.
And all the lords are going to want to go to Scotland now.
Oh, shit.
And everyone says, this is a great idea.
Right.
Is this a great idea?
It's not a good idea at all.
And again, it's casting the English as not just the enemy, but evil.
Yeah.
Pure, pure evil. And speaking of, by the way, we just mentioned it, we're up in Edinburgh, and we've got the lords of Scotland, and there we meet Robert the Bruce, Angus McFadden.
Yeah.
His performance is so odd to me. I think that they're asking him to do something that's very difficult.
Yeah.
Which is to be, everyone say you're this great guy, and to be continuously wimpy and oppressed throughout the entire film.
Yeah, to not know your place in it all.
Yeah.
And because you're being handed a place in it, you haven't earned the place in it, and it bothers you because you aspire to be some kind of heroic figure. And it's ironic because,
well, and Wallace says to him later, jump the timeline a little bit, but is saying, I know you're courageous. I see it in you. And everyone else sees it too. I'm like, how?
Yeah.
Where have they seen this character, this guy?
And to be fair, this whole thing you mentioned about the letter, Robert the Bruce was known historically to jump sides.
He did.
And so it's not historically inaccurate to say that he would have been on the side of the English against the Scots. It is historically accurate to say that he betrayed William Wallace, because there's no record of that
at all.
And ironically, he had the nickname Braveheart.
Yep.
Robert the Bruce, because he asked to have his heart taken out of his body and buried in Scotland when he died.
Yeah.
And that's how he... So Randall, in a little bit, bears some responsibility here about taking the nickname from one and putting it on the other.
Well, him and... I don't know who came up with the title.
Yeah.
But whoever did... I mean, can you imagine, like, here's a guy who, however you want to frame it,
sure,
one of the great heroes of Scotland, and they took his nickname. You know, I mean, can you imagine? I don't know what the great American nickname is.
Yeah, well, they did the life story of Matt Nost, and they called it the Outlaw.
Oh,
that
exactly.
would really bother the shit out of me.
Exactly. Oh, my God. And there's this picture of Matt Nost in the hat.
What the fuck?
And there's some talk of, like, that we hear that Robert, the Lords are talking to him, and Robert yeah. Bruce says, oh, my dad thinks we should lull the English into some, you know, false sense of security or whatever, and they go, where is he? And he goes, oh, he's traveling. And then right. he kind of looks up, and we see a shadow of a person on the ramparts. I'm like, oh, what's up with that? So a little more Scottish history.
Yeah.
So after Alexander III died without an heir, and that's in 1886, all the Scottish lords get together and go, what are we going to do, and who are we going to have be the king? And there's getting close to civil war. Mm-hmm. And as far as I know, Edward Longshanks is not particularly involved in any of this until they say, well, we can't decide between Robert the Bruce mm-hmm. and this other guy, John Balliol.
Yeah, John Balliol.
And they go, you know what? Let's have Edward Longshanks decide. Now, this is where I think this history could be written by the English.
Right.
Exactly how did it end up that Edward got involved? I don't really know. But he says, look, I will support John Balliol as king as long as he swears that I will be the Lord Protector, which basically means like the boss of the king.
Yeah.
And they agree. Now, this is where we can go, wait, how did they agree and what pressure was brought to bear and what agreements were made? And so, and this agreement happened. John Balliol was crowned on the Stone of Scone mm-hmm. in 1292. So this is long after all of the stuff that we has supposedly been happening yeah. in Scotland.
Yeah.
In the next 4 years, Edward put more and more pressure on him to do what he wanted him to do. And King John at the time mm-hmm. refused, got imprisoned in the Tower of London. And in 1896, he renounced Edward II. And that's really where 1295 or 1296. And that's where this really starts. So even though it seems in this movie like this has been going on for decade after decade after decade,
right.
it's really only a couple of years because it's when John Balliol, who was theoretically the king, says, no, I'm not dealing with you, Edward, anymore. That's when the English invaded Scotland.
Yeah.
And did, of course, horrible, horrible stuff.
Mm-hmm. Down to town.
Yeah. So we're back at the old farmhouse, which has seen some better days. Mm-hmm. And up rides a man who we see from behind and from a distance. And we don't know who it is. Yes, we do. We know exactly who this is. And then finally, you see Mel Gibson with the hair,
yeah,
in the outfit, on the horse. He's such a stud.
Supposedly in his 20s.
Yeah, he's 38, I think. He's
38, yes.
It's so funny because he says he didn't want to do it. He said he refused to do it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I don't know. We're in town. There's
no, not me.
there's a fair. People are dancing. He sees this girl in slow motion. And this is Catherine McCormick.
Yeah, she's so good in this.
She's great and gorgeous, beautiful and perfect in every way. Mm-hmm. And Mel shoots her a lot at 28 frames per second. So it's a little slow.
Smart.
Just a little slow. And he says he learned this from Peter Weir.
Oh.
That this was a Peter Weir trick. He said, you want things to look beautiful.
What did they
do? Gallipoli.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
How brilliant.
Yeah.
How interesting. Okay.
You want things, someone to look beautiful, just slow it down just a little, not like slow motion, just moving a little bit slowly.
Gives you time to appreciate it.
Yeah, exactly right.
Fair.
So here's the interesting thing about this. Remember I said that Randall Wallace came up with the little girl and the flower
mm-hmm.
because he felt sad for this guy at the funeral. It wasn't until he got to this scene that he went, suddenly was going, why did William Wallace come back?
Right.
And then he thought, oh, it's for the girl.
Mm-hmm.
Is that he didn't, it wasn't intended. He didn't plan on the girl at the funeral being the girl at the fair.
Oh.
He just went, I need a reason. I need this girl at the funeral for this reason.
Right.
I need him to come back. Oh, what if the same girl is there? And that's who he came back for. That was his reason. Mm-hmm. And so, and this is so, is that writing's like this, at least for me a lot, which is you discover things
mm-hmm.
and people go like, oh no, you planned that. It's like, no, I had no idea that was going to happen
right.
until it was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course it seems so obvious that it has to happen. And just as he's about to talk to Catherine McCormick, who steps in front of him but Hamish.
You've dropped your rock.
Test of manhood. You win.
Brendan Gleeson.
Yeah.
I he's not recognizable
he's
to me.
He's unrecognizable in this movie.
Even knowing that's who that is.
He's so vibrant and full of life. He feels younger than Mel Gibson. It's mind-blowing.
Well, and because you picture, how I picture him is a completely different kind of person.
Absolutely.
Hamish is the most aggressively manly, testosterone-filled guy in the world.
1,000,000%.
Yeah.
And he's never played a role like this since.
And he has a big rock.
Yeah.
Yes, he does.
He drops that rock at their feet, and there's a discussion of, that's a big rock? and he says, oh, well, the English don't let us train with real weapons, so we have to train with this. Right. I don't know if that's true or not. And then we go into let's throw the rock contest, which is very Scottish.
Yes.
There's a lot of these...
Oh, yeah, the Highland Games
yeah. things that are just these kinds of stuff. Yep. Have you ever watched them?
Yeah, yes, and
they're awesome.
ESPN used to show them.
Yeah.
And you can go to Highland Games or Scottish Games around here in the U.S. Like, they do exhibition events and things of that nature, so you can see that. Throwing the log, well, that whole nine, yeah.
And there's this moment where he's saying, you know, this is what we need to do for soldiers. And Mel says, oh, the test of soldiers isn't in your arms. It's here, pointing to his head. And Hamish goes, no, it's here. And he punches him in the mouth.
Yeah.
And then Mel gets up and goes, Hamish? Which is great. And later on, we're in the contest. And Mel throws a rock. Pretty good.
Yep.
Pretty good throw. It's a big rock.
Yeah.
And then Hamish throws a rock and wins. And then... You know, William Wallace kind of asked, like, I was wondering if you could do that when it matters.
Could you crush a man with that throw? I could crush you like a worm. You could?
Aye.
Well, then do it.
Would you like to see him crush me like a worm?
And he stands in front of me. He's like, you'll move.
You'll move.
This scene is so...
Won't. You'll move.
And he throws it, and throws it right over his head.
Yep.
It's a funny bit.
It is.
And an even better bit comes right afterwards.
Because he hits a small rock, hits Hamish right in the center of the forehead.
Yeah, right. And Hamish has a great line. He says, should have remembered about the rocks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He says, you should have moved. And now he's going to go talk to the girl.
Right.
Except another girl comes up and says, William, will you dance with me? And he says, of course I will. And they go and dance. And then in come the British.
Right.
And in comes the Lord. And his... speech is so horrible and so pompous. I mean, like, he's a perfect actor to cast to just hate.
I come to claim the right of Prima Nocta. As lord of these lands, I will bless this marriage by taking the bride into my bed on the first night of her union.
Oh, by God, you will not!
And then that guy gets taken out.
Yep.
And we see that the husband is... Tommy Flanagan, yep. Who we saw in Gladiator was the last time we saw him.
That's right, as a Maximilian's servant.
Servant, yeah. Cicero?
Cicero, yes.
Well, I don't know how I remember that. And now again, the beautiful use of slow-mo as the bride walks through the people.
Great song, great score as well in this moment.
And it's almost...
very heartbreaking.
Angelic, you know, as she floats
sacrificial.
Through them. It's sacrificial. Yep. That she has accepted... So there's a purity in what she is doing, mm-hmm. and she leans into Tommy Flanagan, who is her husband, and whispers something to him, mm-hmm. and touches everyone to get the... because this is about to be a riot.
Yeah.
And she stops it all.
It's almost like Christ.
Absolutely.
Right? After the apostle sliced the ear of the Roman soldier, he is walking amongst them, stopping the violence. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's all happening in slow-mo, and the soldiers let go of Tommy Flanagan, and we see that evil soldier.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh, that's a bad guy.
Yeah, the old guy with the
old
eyes.
Guy.
Yeah.
And the soldiers right away, and the evil soldier dude just laughs, and he walks right past William Wallace, who looks at him. Yeah. It's a really good scene.
The English are terrible, man.
Yeah.
At least in this movie.
No, they're evil. I mean, they're like, you know, Dark Lord level of, you know, yeah. Darth Vader level of evil.
Palpatine.
Yeah. Yes. Totally. Yeah. It's raining. William Wallace rides up to the farm of one of his dad's friends and asks to see his daughter.
I was wondering if I might have a word with your daughter. What do you want to have a word with her about?
And the dialogue is really funny. And she's sitting in the house kind of watching and smiling. And he says,
"Oh, it's good Scottish weather, madam. The rain is falling straight down. Oh, slightly from the side, like."
And then they go, "She can't go with you now. Know the now.
Know the now, anyway.
Know the now. Know the now.
Know the now." And then she just runs out and jumps on the horse.
Right.
And they ride off. Again, great music.
Yep.
I'm going to keep saying it. And great cinematography. This is John Toll. This is beautiful. And by the way, it was shot maybe 6 weeks in Scotland. Most of this is shot in Ireland.
Oh, okay.
It was cheaper, less built up,
yeah,
and more free labor, but it rained a lot.
Of course.
But the locations are great.
Yeah.
And they kind of talk about how they knew each other after so long, and why would she, are you in the habit of riding off with strangers?
Right.
And he said, "Well, I would have sent a note, but she doesn't know how to read." And then he says, "He'll teach her to read." And then, in what language?
Mm.
And he's just showing off.
Bragging off.
Speaks French. He
classic
speaks Latin.
Dude. Classic, yep. Dude.
And I love the line, say that standing on your head and I'll be impressed.
Right.
And he says, "My kilt will fly up." There were no kilts.
There were no kilts. Historically inaccurate. Kilts like, didn't come out for another, like, what?
400 years.
Yeah, 400
it's like
years.
1700 when kilts show up. Still kilts. Which, and it's so funny. It's like, what? Here's my feeling about it. It's like, they're historically accurate. Movies are not supposed to be textbooks.
Right.
And so the kilts, while incorrect, or the bagpipes, while incorrect, they don't bother me as much as the timeline, because
right.
The kilts, it's just what they're wearing.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to the whole motivation for William Wallace's character and the whole situation that he's fighting against and the whole theme of the film
right.
is brought into question because the timeline doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and I hear you. And I think the kilts thing is a brilliant... Because
you go Scottish. You
know, right, exactly.
Yeah.
It's remember,
and bagpipes.
You're making this for an American audience in 95. You're not making this for necessarily a worldwide audience. You're looking domestically. This is where the money was at in 95. So you make a film that appeals to that. What do most Americans know about Scotland? Kilts and bagpipes.
And bagpipes.
So immediately drop those 10 poles in the ground, and you're good to go from here.
I think your theory is completely right, mm-hmm. but I will add to it that it's not like the Scottish people didn't like this movie.
Oh, right. Exactly. They did.
They loved
it. Of course.
It. So they didn't care that it was historically
of course.
Either.
Yeah, because it's a badass movie.
And he brings her back home. She's getting some bad looks, and they're looking at each other, and this is the look of love. I mean, mm-hmm. this is, you know, it's obvious. And she starts to go. He grabs her hand and pulls her back. And he reaches into his clothing and pulls out a cloth
mm-hmm.
and hands it to her. And then he smiles. He jumps on his horse. She opens it up. And there is the pressed flower she gave to him at the funeral. Okay, I'm going to continue this thing about Randall Wallace. Because, again, I have issues with him in terms of the accuracy. But this is where he's 100%, I totally understand this.
Perfect.
Which is that he didn't know that Mel had saved the flower. He didn't know.
Oh.
He knew. He was writing this scene where they're saying goodbye. And he wanted them to have a last moment.
Mm-hmm.
And he went, well, they can't kiss. That's
right.
Not
it's
correct.
It's too early.
It's too early. They can't. The parents are right there. We can't kiss that. And their love isn't about that. Their love needs to be pure mm-hmm. and special. And he went, Mel should give her something. What could William Wallace give her? And then he went, he kept the flower.
Yeah.
So he only introduced the girl and the flower because of his feelings about the funeral. He only had, he realized that Mel came back for the girl only when he was writing the scene. And now he only realized the flower is going to come back when he was in the middle of writing the scene. And that is how writing feels to me.
Yeah.
It's so, the best things, they just come like, oh my God. And you realize you set up a thing, but you didn't know you were setting anything up. You were just dealing with the problem at that moment. Mm-hmm. And that moment is like, tears are in your eyes.
Yeah.
When she opens that thing and sees the flower, it is amazing.
Yeah.
That is a great, great filmic moment. He's working on her house, and dad comes up with Hamish's dad, and they're inviting him to a meeting,
mm-hmm.
the secret kind. And he doesn't want to go.
I came back home to raise crops and, God willing, a family.
With a little look at her dad.
If I can live in peace, I will.
And dad goes, good, you stay out of the troubles, and maybe you have a chance with my daughter. And he's right. like, didn't I just do that?
Yeah.
And
then they have a nice funny back and forth.
Little funny back and forth. It's that night. He throws some rocks at the house. She comes out. Again, they run out. Beautiful love theme. and they're talking, and he says something about
running a farm's a lot of work, but that'll all change when my sons arrive.
So you've got children?
Well, not yet, but I was hoping that you could help me with that.
And then she says, you want to marry me? I love that he tricked her into proposing him. Right. He's like, well, it's a bit sudden, but all right. She says, is that a proposal? And you remember what he says?
I love you. Always have. I want to marry you.
Yeah. And they kiss, and there's that love theme. It's the next night. They're running off in the woods together, and he says, you know, going to hurry. He's going to be waiting. Well, who's going to be waiting? Well, it ends up it's a priest, and we are in this beautifully, perfectly lit scene with the priest, and there is a wedding ceremony. He wraps their hands together, and they say their vows, and she hands him this embroidered cloth, which is going to be a key sort of token that he's going to carry with him that's going to become very important, and they say vows to each other, and the camera pulls back, and we dissolve to him carrying her through the woods, and he walks towards her, and they're naked, and there's... It's cold because the breath that you could see their breath. I mean, it looks really cold.
It looks really cold,
which is, you know, it's hard to do certain things.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't just mean physically. I just mean for the actors to be out. It looks like it's 30 degrees out.
Yeah.
Looks really, really cold. But the scene is gorgeous.
It is. And I think it's the same score as as the girl when she's going with the knight, the lord.
Oh, really?
I think it's the same kind of...
It has a similar feeling.
Which I think is a foreboding of what's going to happen to that love.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's the next morning, and she's kind of helping him get dressed. Mm-hmm. And it's very beautiful and very romantic. And we're back in the village, and she's carrying vegetables in a basket. Mm-hmm. And again, it's that slight slow-mo. And he's watching her, and she turns, and they smile at each other. And... they come together, and there's that creepy soldier man. Mm-hmm. He's watching them.
Eating that apple.
Eating whatever it is. Oh, he's the serpent.
Yeah.
Oh, the apple. Oh.
It's all there. Mel is very religious, man.
And he asks, you know, when are we going to see her? And there's this great, like, tonight. No, it's too early.
Yeah.
Tonight. and they separate, and we're back to that creepy soldier.
It's the playful love. It's that young love. It's the new love, right?
It's perfect.
It's like, it's that kind of thing where we know we shouldn't, but we have to. We can't get enough of each other.
I think it's, for the amount of screen time it has, which is very little.
You're right.
They just nail it perfectly. Yep. You're completely 100% invested in this relationship, and you understand the life they want to have together, and you see how special it is. And then this creepy soldier goes, you know, look lively, Sergeant. Essentially, we got a live one.
Yeah.
And they follow her, and she's surrounded, and she tries to fight her way out, and he grabs her and throws her on the ground and licks her.
Yeah, it's weird.
And says, "You remind me of my daughter," which that was his line. He made that up.
It's even worse.
It's horrible. And she's trying to fight her way out, and their clothes get ripped. And then there's William Wallace. Takes one guy out with a rock, takes another guy out, and gets her up on her feet. And, you know, they try to essentially walk away casually. And he gets her up on a horse, and you see the soldiers are starting to come towards her. And he says, meet me at the grove. And she rides away, and he fights the soldier, and he sees, oh, she's gotten away. And we think, oh, this is going to be okay. And she's galloping away, and then she gets hit by a spear and knocked off the horse. And the way they did this is this was shot. It's the opposite. It's shot at 8 frames per second. Mm. So you showed a really slow frame rate, so it happens really fast. And she actually reacts in slow motion. And then you speed the whole thing up, and it happens really suddenly. And then you take a couple of frames out, so it doesn't have smooth movement. So the spear almost jumps a little bit right before it hits her.
Right.
And then you duplicate frames. So you've taken 2 frames out, and then you add the same frame in twice. So the image stills for just 2 frames.
Okay.
And that makes that impact look more. And this he learned from George Miller.
There we go.
Is that is great action scene, because it looks brutal.
It does.
It looks really horrible.
And her coughing out of breath.
Yeah.
Because she's had the wind knocked out of her and blood coming out of her mouth is even more so.
And Mel, now dressed as a soldier, is at the grove.
Right.
She's not there.
Right.
And it's just, oh shit. And he calls her name, and we're back in the village, and this lord has put her up against a post, and she's tied up, and he basically makes some speech about, look, you know, I've been really nice to you guys. other than the Prima Nocta thing, and you know, but an attack on the king's guards is an attack on the king, and this, you know, and so there's got to be some punishment. And he pulls out his dagger, and it happens really fast.
That's the thing, man.
He slits her throat.
She's even surprised at the, which is a great reaction from her, the shock of how quickly she's going to die. Yeah,
it's shocking.
Yeah,
I mean, it is really. And of course, you know what kind of movie this is, but that is just so, because you're so into this couple. And
right. And I think that's why it's brilliant the way their love scenes are constructed, Steve. Like you said, it's they're making the most of a limited amount of screen time so that when this death happens, it has the most weight.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Because it's new love. Everyone knows new love. Everyone knows that first love and the joy of that. To have it suddenly ripped away from you. You now are fully invested in William Wallace.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And now we're into our first big battle scene.
Yeah.
This one's amazing. The slow setup is so powerful, and the use of slow motion.
Yeah.
First they're waiting for him, and then they see him coming.
Yeah.
And he is slowly riding, seemingly unarmed, into this village towards the garrison. And the guards are slowly moving in, and they kind of see him, and then he goes behind something.
Yeah.
And then we see him looking through like fire, and you see the waves of heat, you know, kind of vibrating. You see the slow motion hooves going into the mud. You see soldiers moving in, and you hear the breathing of the horse. And I think that's so powerful. And there's this look on Mel's face, which is of loss and pain and resignation and almost, you know what? It relates to the woman who gave herself to the Lord.
Right.
It's this sort of, there's a sense of inevitability about what's about to happen. Mm-hmm. There's a shot that it's one of my favorite shots in any film ever of the empty blue sky and the muzzle of the horse coming into frame at this weird angle and a hand reaching up because the guards have moved in to take the reins of the horse. I don't know what about that shot, but it's so beautiful to me.
There are quite a few interesting camera placements throughout the whole movie.
And Mel has lifted his arms up to his sides, and it's definitely Christ-like again.
Yep.
And his hands go up behind his head, and there's two soldiers coming in, one that seems sort of aggressive and more knowledgeable, and the other soldier who looks really young.
Yeah.
Really, really young. And he's looking up at Mel, and Mel looks down at him, and there is a long pause as his hands are kind of behind his neck. And I think there is a look on William Wallace's face at this moment of regret.
Yep.
You see that too.
Pity. I see pity and regret.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I know I'm about to kill you.
Yeah.
And you don't know it's coming.
Right.
And you aren't the person who killed my wife, but this is now what has to happen.
Yep.
And he pulls out that big morning star, and we go from slow motion, and bam, he knocks that guy out. The other guy shoots a spear in the horse. There were no animals hurt in this film.
Yeah.
And Mel goes down, and he comes up with this, like, antler thing between his hands right into the guy's throat. And this fight scene is great.
And brutal.
Brutal. Well, that's what we're going to see in this movie.
Yep.
Like, this movie is, it earns its R rating for violence. I mean, it is nasty. Mm-hmm. Cuts a guy's leg off. You know how they do that?
Reverse.
Hire a dude with one leg.
Suppose that helps.
It helps. And then there's like, you know, then he throws his sword to kill another guy.
Right.
Picks up a big maul hammer thing. Hamish is in behind him, blocks one thing, hose the hammer to Hamish. We kill the guy with the. I mean, there's like a lot of cool just stuff going on in a very kind of realistic way. And then once that's happening, everybody shows up. Hamish's dad, Tommy Flanagan, like all of these people show up. And suddenly the sheriff, which I think he's a sheriff inside the garrison, he gets scared.
Yep.
Summons archers to the towers. How do we defend ourselves from these archers? Carry some bodies.
Exactly. Right on top.
Right on top.
Yep.
Hamish's dad gets hit with an arrow, and Hamish tries to pull it out. And I love the moment of like dad screams and just clocks him.
Yeah.
Damn it, boy. And they break off the end of the arrow and let's keep fighting.
Cosmo is so tough in this movie.
He is tough, man. And, well, he's so tough, in fact, that he runs, while Wallace climbs up the tower to throw archers off these towers, he goes and lifts up the gate of this thing so other guys can come in. And there's a great moment where there's a guy's spear coming right at him, and he's going, I can't drop the gate. Yep. I'm just going to die holding this gate. And the guys come in just in time to save him. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
And there's one bad cut, by the way.
Oh.
There's a moment where Mel, I think, throws a guy off the roof, and he's going to get impaled on one of the spiky wood things in the fence. And it's so obvious that the angle is wrong.
Oh.
He falls, and he's not going to, it's not going to happen right.
Right.
And then they cut to him getting impaled, and it's always bothered me. And I bet, I think Steven Rosenblum is the name of the editor, who's fantastic. I mean, this is a beautifully edited movie. Shit like that drives you crazy. I am sure that he hated it. He knew it wasn't a great cut. It was the only way he could do it for whatever reason. And he's just like, I could never quite get that thing exactly right.
Damn it, Mel.
But we've taken the garrison. And it's suddenly over very fast. And there is a look between Mel and the sheriff and a long pause and then a hard cut to him getting just kicked down the hill.
Yeah.
And he...
And the way he holds on to his cape is almost almost like a... A woman holding on to her dress, and it is it's meant to show that he's not like a masculine thing. Do you know what I'm saying? It's done on purpose.
Well, and I mean, this is a guy who thought he had it all controlled, all the power.
Yeah.
And that power got taken away from
his arrogance of that speech. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. Really fast.
Yeah.
And he is put up against the post.
Yep.
And there's pause. And then he slits his throat.
And he's just as surprised as Mara was.
And this one you really see.
Yeah.
I mean, it is nasty. And Mel,
and Mel has an almost distant look on his face because it's like, it's all, he's almost like left his body.
Yeah, he's disconnected.
Yeah, he's disconnected completely emotionally. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. And we've already said we think he's a great director. Guy's a great actor.
He is a fantastic actor, man.
I mean, I remember when we did Lethal Weapon a couple of years ago now. But... his performance, the suicide scene in Lethal Weapon, is like one of the most stunning scenes of acting I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And you see a lot of that same intensity and power in this movie.
I've never seen him give a bad performance, man. Even in terrible movies. I've never, even in Tequila Sunrise. Yeah, I've never seen him give a bad performance.
I'd have to really go back and study Bird on a Wire and a whole bunch of other films.
But he's having fun in Bird on a Wire, right?
I have no memory of it, really.
He's never necessarily bad. He's never been bad.
Is he Air America, too?
Air America as well.
Yeah. I don't. I mean, I loved him so much, but I don't really need to revisit some of these films.
Yeah.
I did watch Tequila Sunrise maybe 3 years ago.
Yeah?
It's not a good movie.
No, it's not a good movie.
Yeah.
They tried to be, though.
Yeah. And then the Scottish start chanting McCullough. And then we go into chanting Wallace.
Yeah.
Yeah. Funeral. She's wrapped in a shroud.
Oh, man, that's heartbreaking.
Beautiful shot. He touches her face. He kisses her. Mm-hmm. The family's there. There's crying. Her dad comes up, and you see this moment of him, and he kneels down in front of him for his blessing and for forgiveness.
Uh-huh.
And dad's hand comes out, and then he can't do it. And then finally he does. And this to me echoes little William not being able to touch his father.
Right.
And he does, you know, and when you see in the wide shot, he is really grabbing onto that wig that Mel Gibson is wearing.
Well, I also think it's full circle, right? He met her at the funeral.
Oh,
and she leaves
him at
the
funeral. You're totally right. I hadn't thought of that.
It's full circle.
That's a great point.
It's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Fuck, it's heartbreaking.
Later that night, we have Hamish, who's got a hot poker, and he's going up to Dad because he got to cauterize the mood, and he goes to Tommy Flanagan and goes, I'll hold him, you do it.
You do it.
And then Tommy Flanagan gets another guy, I'll hold him, you do it.
Right.
And they put that hot poker with the whiskey into the guy's wound.
Oh. What is he say? What are you afraid of, boy? Do it, boy, or something like that.
And then they hold him down, and then he leaps up, punches someone out, and says,
"Yeah,
that'll wake you up in the morning, boy." He's the best.
He's good.
He's such a good character. And then someone's coming, and they grab weapons, and it's the clan, the next clan.
Yeah.
And they're like, "Hey, we're here to join you."
Right.
And Wallace goes, "No.
Some of us are in this. Can't help that now. But you can help yourselves. Go home."
And they go, look, the English are going to come after us after they come after you. And they go, okay. So they all join us. So now we're going to be one big group, and we're traveling. And we see them going through a river, and we hear the bagpipes, and the army is going through the trees. And now we're at another fort. And this one's a bigger one,
yeah,
more heavily armed. And this stuff is all built, by the way. This is not, you know, this is all sets. And men ride in and dismount. British, English soldiers, we think. Mm-hmm. But of course, it's William Wallace. This is not a very, didn't they have like a call sign or anything? And the Lord there, and this is the guy that slept with the woman from the
yes.
previous scene. He goes, hey, I've dispatched 100 soldiers and they're about to be returning. Wallace goes,
what are they dressed like this?
It says, right. By the way, they were 50. The English did not wear uniforms at this time.
Again, no.
Not a big deal, but that's another one. And then he turns to Tommy Flanagan and says, make it quick.
Yeah.
And he's got a big morning star.
Yeah.
And or a mall. I don't remember which it is. Mm-hmm. And he goes, it was my right as a lord. And he says, well, I'm here to claim the right of a husband.
Yeah.
Bam.
Yeah.
It's very satisfying. We get a little speech that he's going to let the rest of you guys go.
Go back to England and tell them there that Scotland's daughters and her sons are yours no more. Tell them Scotland is free.
And then a pause and
burn it.
They like to burn stuff down.
That's one of my favorite lines. Burn it. The way he says it, it's like, oh.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Back in England, the prince is practicing some archery with his guy. Dad walks in. There's a lot of looks. And he says,
Scottish rebels have routed one of my garrisons and murdered the noble lord.
And the prince is like, well, just have him arrested.
Right.
Have this Wallace guy arrested.
Leave us.
And he asks everyone to go. And then when everyone's gone, he hits the prince.
Wallace has already killed the magistrate and taken control of the town.
He says, one day you'll be king. At least try to act like one. And the wife, Isabella, comes to comfort him. And he goes, no, get me my military council.
Right.
Because he's going to be in charge. Because dad's going to go off to France. And he's the one who's going to have to deal with William Wallace.
Yes.
And then a maid comes up who's an important character and comes to Isabella. And she says, I hope your husband goes to fight William Wallace and he kills him. And then you're going to be a widow. It's like, wow, strong statements here. And now we see the British soldiers, the English soldiers' revenge.
She's like the best friend that comes up. You know what, honey? He don't deserve you. He don't deserve you, girl.
Some English soldiers ride over a hill in the fog, and there are a couple of men sitting, a couple of Scottish men in a fire, and they chase them. Right. They chase them into like a cliff, and they're totally trapped. And they and as they're saying,
no point resisting. You're outnumbered and trapped.
We see behind them on the cliffs, all around them, William Wallace and his army.
Yep.
And it is awesome.
Yeah.
And bang, gets hit in the head by a rock. And cut to William Wallace standing there with more rocks smiling. That's great.
Yep.
Love it. Let's go see Robert the Bruce.
Let's do it.
A rebellion has begun.
And we see this man behind the screen.
Under whom?
A commoner named William Wallace.
And we finally see Dad, who has leprosy,
mm-hmm.
which he didn't.
He didn't?
No.
Oh, okay. Also historically inaccurate.
Yes.
What's the point of it? Why give him leprosy? Interesting.
Because it makes him look evil.
Okay.
I don't like this stuff. This is, but the
yeah.
Robert the Bruce and Dad is my least favorite stuff.
I agree.
Because he's just, it literally is Emperor Palpatine.
Yeah.
You know, like that's how it feels.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good point.
And they're talking about Wallace and Dad says, it's great. You support him with our lands in the north and I'll support England with lands that are south.
Mm.
And we're going to play this sort of game. And he goes, well, look, Wallace is, he's inspiring people. They want to fight for him.
And you wish to charge off and fight as he did, eh? So would I, eh?
Well, maybe it's time.
It is time to survive.
You're the 17th Robert the Bruce. There's 16 before you. Like, we have a legacy. We got to, and we need the nobles and we need the English.
Yeah.
And he's still talking to Robert, our young Robert the Bruce is kind of going, no, I like him. He goes, yeah. Oh, you admire him.
Uncompromising men are easier to admire. There's courage, so does a dog. But it is exactly the ability to compromise that makes a man noble.
It's an interesting statement.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. Yeah, I don't know what game he's really playing here.
It's preservation.
Yeah.
Of the line, right? Yeah.
Yeah. There's some more battle, and we're back to, and this is, again, our prince with his buddy walking down a hallway with someone carrying a mirror so they could look at themselves and their outfits. And this is just like, here are the cliches.
Yep.
And then we have the maid and Isabella talking, and she had found out some stuff about Wallace, mm-hmm. which she found out through sex, and we get some little dirty jokes, and that Wallace was into this for a woman. Mm-hmm. And she tells the story of Wallace's wife and how she was killed, and that's how this whole thing started, and that even that they set up an ambush at her graves, but he fought his way through the trap, and he carried her body to a secret place. And Isabella loves this story because yeah. it is so romantic and it's so beautiful. And it's so, you know, like them setting up, again, this is where I'm not comfortable with how the movie handles this, is the gay husband with his lover and right. her lack of satisfaction and her, and the contrast with that, with the manly Mel Gibson, William Wallace.
Yeah.
It's not my favorite thing in the movie.
I agree.
The other thing is this story of William Wallace doing this whole thing for his wife who mm-hmm. was killed. Well, first of all, in the books of Blind Harry, her name is Marion.
Yeah.
And not Moron or whatever the right. name is here. And the reason they changed it, do you know?
It's because it's too close to Maid Marian from Robin Hood.
Too close to Maid Marian from Robin Hood.
Right.
The other thing is that in the first versions of Blind Harry's script or poem,
yeah.
there is no Marian.
Yeah.
There's no evidence at all that he was ever married. So the whole motivation is something that doesn't exist.
Right. It's so weird, the yeah. decision to include it. But apparently it was a family who paid to have him include her in it so that they could claim they had relatives of her or ancestors of her. Yeah. People.
Yeah. Well, and also, I mean, Blind Harry, I mean, this was written as a pro-Scotland, anti-English yeah. poem. I mean, this is propaganda.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, look, this is what we all do. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, look at Captain America.
Yeah.
You know, talk about a pro-American
right.
piece of literature. And I love Captain America.
Listen, Henry V is one of the most revered pieces of literature. That yeah. is a pro-England play.
This is what we do. This is what people do,
yep.
you know, in their countries.
Yep.
Wallace and his men are sitting around there eating. We're talking about the fact that eventually Longshanks is going to bring the heavy cavalry.
Right.
And nobody's ever stood against them. It's not possible. And it's like, what are we going to do? And Hamish's dad, whose name I keep forgetting, mm-hmm. He says, we're going to go back up to the mountains. It's the Highland Way. And we'll hide out until they go away. And then we come back down. And during this time, William Wallace is looking up at the trees. And he says,
we'll make spears. Hundreds of them. Long spears. Twice as long as a man.
Well, your mom's been telling stories about me again. Hasn't
Some men are longer than others. It's so funny.
Yeah.
And then up comes these two guys, and the first guy kind of kneels down in front of William Wallace right. and offers him his service and starts to pull something out, and it's a piece of fabric, but they're like, whoa, 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 what are you doing? And they go, no, don't worry, we checked him.
Right.
It's an important little plant. And as he's kind of swearing service to Wallace, up comes this other guy. Mm-hmm. And his performance as Stephen is awesome.
Mm-hmm. Him, that can't be William Wallace. I'm prettier than this man.
And he eats their stew.
He
breaks every convention that you are supposed to adhere to when you're meeting new people,
yes.
especially new warriors.
Well, and in particular, looking up at the sky you're and right. saying, all right, Father, I'll ask him.
If I risk my neck for you, will I get a chance to kill Englishmen?
And Amos is like, are you talking to a ghost or are you addressing the Almighty? And his line is,
in order to find his equal, an Irishman is forced to talk to God. Yes, Father, the Almighty says, don't change the subject. Just answer the fucking question.
And they go, watch your fucking mouth.
Yeah.
And someone calls him insane, and he draws a knife, and it goes right at Hamish's dad.
Right.
And they all draw their weapons, and we have a standoff. Mm-hmm. We'll say a Scottish-Irish standoff. Really fast.
Smart enough to get a dagger past your guards, old man.
And Wallace says, in answer to your question, yes.
Yeah.
Apparently, by the way, someone in The Patriot, which I have no memory of, asks Mel Gibson's character the exact question. If I fight for you, will I have the chance to kill Englishmen?
Right. It's Chechki Kario.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's him. He's the one who asks him as a Frenchman. He says, do I get a chance to kill the
Englishmen? That's funny.
Yeah.
I have no memory of that movie.
It's a terrible movie.
Yeah.
Why would you have a memory of it?
And then he says,
excellent. Stephen is my name. I'm the most wanted man on my island. Except I'm not on my island, of course.
Your island? You mean Ireland? Yes.
It's mine.
It's mine. And his laughing like a madman is so fun and so crazy. In the next scene, William's out hunting a stag. Mm-hmm. It's very slow. He's got his bow and arrow. He knocks an arrow. He pulls it back. And as he's kind of starting to aim at this stag, we see Stephen, the Irishman, coming up behind him in slow motion. And we see him come in. William doesn't see him yet. And then we see the other guy who just showed up, and he's coming up. And they're coming up from opposite directions, and we're going, oh my God, these are assassins.
Right.
They're here to kill him. And then we see Stephen draw his knife, and we see the other guy draw a sword, and William finally hears it, turns, and is bringing the arrow to kill Stephen, but can't quite get there in time. And Stephen throws his knife and hits the other guy who was actually coming to kill him. That's a great, great moment.
It is.
Perfectly set up.
It messes with the audience because, of course, you would think the rude one is the one that is. Yeah.
No, it's a great moment.
Yeah.
Here's what's interesting. So there was going to be a whole night battle scene where Stephen proved his worth.
Right.
And then I don't know if it was from budget or time or just because Mel was exhausted, which he was throughout this whole thing.
I'm sure.
They said, we got to cut this. And then David O'Hara, I think is the actor's name, comes up and says, listen, if you cut that, you cut my whole character. That's the whole moment.
Right.
And they come up with this scene to replace it.
That's perfect.
Which was cheap and easy, and they shot in an afternoon.
Totally.
And it's fantastic. And
David O'Hara, if you guys don't, if you guys remember David O'Hara, he is the father of James McAvoy in Wanted, and in The Departed, he's the guy that goes, "Where's your boy?" when they throw Martin Sheen off the thing. That's him. It's incredible to see how David O'Hara and Brendan Gleeson are so young and vibrant in this movie, but the next time we see them in years afterwards, they look older as hell. It's incredible how they look so young and vibrant in this movie.
People could see the way we've aged during the course of the Cinephiles. It's like the same thing.
Yeah, totally the same thing. Absolutely.
They're hiking through the mountains, and there's great music, and runners come up, and they say the English are coming towards Stirling.
Right.
And they ask about Robert the Bruce, and it's like, well, he and the other lords won't commit, but the Highlands are coming down in hundreds and thousands.
Yeah.
And William Wallace says,
are you ready for a war? Yeah!
And we come to the Battle of Stirling.
Yeah. Which is, we'll get to it, I guess. Also historically inaccurate.
Not accurate. I think you probably watched all the same stuff I watched.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, because I love the movie, I wanted to be precise with it, with you.
Yeah. That's what the Cinephiles is all about.
Yeah.
Precision. Ryder comes up, and we see our lords are waiting. We see all these Scottish men lined up, and they say, you know, the British have everything. I keep doing that. The English have 300 horse, which means we can't win because nobody can stand up to heavy cavalry.
Right.
And then there's a rumble. And we see in the distance spears coming over from the distance, and we see the arrival of the British English army. I'm going to stop doing that. It is impressive.
Mm-hmm.
It is scary. And this is the time of huge, huge cast. These are thousands of people. What they mostly did, there was mostly the Irish army, by the way, because we're in Ireland, and that they would shoot one day, and they would all be dressed as the Scottish, and then the next day, they'd change their clothes, and they're all the English.
That makes sense.
And this shot of them appearing that is so intimidating, it was an afterthought. It wasn't in their shooting schedule at all, and suddenly someone went, hey, we never showed the English showing up.
Yeah.
And they went, oh, we got to get that, and that's they added all this stuff.
Makes sense.
And the guy who is handling all this, these huge crowds, is David Tomlinson. Do you know who this is? I didn't know. He is the AD who handled the largest crowd scene ever filmed, as far as I know, which is like 100,000 people in Gandhi.
Wow.
He's the AD for Gandhi.
Wow. Okay.
Mel scored when he got this guy.
Yeah, I'm sure.
This is a guy who can handle some big crowds.
Mm-hmm.
The logistics, just you have to feed these people. You have to put all the costumes of the people. You got to get makeup on the people. You have to organize them. You have to all get them going in the right direction. Yep. I don't know how. I've never been on a movie set like this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, very few people have. I can't imagine what it takes to organize something like this.
Yeah.
It's crazy. And the score is great as the British come in. And now the commoners are going, look, I didn't come here to fight so they could win more lands, that I'd have to work for them.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a really good point.
All right, lads. I'm not dying for these bastards. Let's go home.
Which sucks for the lords, because if they don't have their army there, they can't negotiate to get more lands.
By the way, that guy is a fantastic Scottish actor, Peter Mullen.
Oh, that's who that is?
Yeah, he's done a number of films. If you ever saw Session 9, that incredibly insane horror film at a mental institution. And he's done a number of films that are smaller British. I can't remember the director he works with all the time, but he did a film called Joe, which is really incredible as well. So yeah, great, great actor. It was shocking because I was getting into independent movies out around this time in the 90s. I'd seen him in a couple of things. It was shocking to see him play such a small part in this movie.
And then just as they're starting to leave and we look like this isn't going to go at all, up rides William Wallace and his men in the blue war paint.
Yeah.
And everyone's got the war paint on. Mm-hmm. And he's got, I think it's something kind of cross. I forget what it is called.
Yeah.
That has now been worn at football matches all across Scotland.
That's right. William Wallace.
Can't be. No tall enough.
Which comes from Blind Harry, by the way. Blind Harry wrote that he was 7 feet tall. Mm-hmm. By the way, the blue war paint, no.
Yeah.
That's from the Picts. The Picts wore blue war paint when they fought the Romans 1,000 years earlier. It looks awesome.
Yeah.
It is so great.
It's a brilliant choice.
It's brilliant. Yeah. And they have all these men have big bundles of something. I love Stephen's line.
The Almighty says this must be a fashionable fight. It's drawn the finest people.
So good. And the lords are like, where's your salute? And William Wallace is like, look, thanks for coming.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saluting you. And then he rides over to the men and makes the speech.
Yeah.
And it's amazing.
It's a shorter speech than people remember.
Yeah.
But it is to the point. And once again, he's speaking to the commoners in a way that's relatable, right? He says,
sons of Scotland. I am William Wallace.
William Wallace is 7 feet tall.
Yes, I've heard. He kills men by the hundred. And if he were here, he'd consume the English with fireballs from his eyes and bolts of lightning from his arse. I am William Wallace. And I see a whole army of my countrymen here in defiance of tyranny. You've come to fight as free men. And free men you are.
And I'm proud. So he's connecting with them. He's like, yeah. I'm one of you. And you know, I'm proud. You've heard the legend of me, but you guys are the reason why this is possible.
What will you do with that freedom? Will you fight?
Against that? No. We will run.
And we will live. Die. Fight and you may die. Run and you'll live. At least a while. And dying in your beds many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take oh, freedom!
And the freedom thing at the end, it's a big deal. Freedom is a big deal in this movie.
You think? the speech is amazing.
Yeah.
It is very much, and Randall Wallace says this, it is very much Henry V.
Oh, yes.
St. Crispin's Day.
1,000%.
This is that kind of a speech.
Yep.
One of the things that Mel said that I think is totally right is he got a lot of juice from the horse, because every time he yelled, the horse would try to bolt.
Of course.
And then he would have to control the horse. And you as an actor know, when you have to deal with a thing, you're in the moment now. Now it's real. And he said it really helped him. And he also is so grateful that the camera operator and the first assistant cameraman, the first AC, were so good, because he had no idea where that horse was going to go.
Right.
And that means that they have to continually move with him. And in order to have things in focus, the first AC's job is to pull focus, which means if you go 2 feet farther away, I have to change the focus.
Right.
If you go 6 inches in, I have to keep moving this little knob to keep you in focus all the time, which is super hard when a dude's on a horse that he's not controlling that well, and you don't know where it's going to go.
Right.
The scene's amazing. And the speech works, and the lords are not pleased. Right. And they're like, look, we're going to have to go off. We're going to go talk to the English, because they still want to make a deal.
Yeah, they want to negotiate.
Yeah. And William rides off too. Where are you going to go?
I'm going to pick a fight.
And they go off to the English.
What does he say? He says, well, I didn't get dressed up for nothing.
Yeah.
Right.
Hamish says.
And the lords are doing some introductions, and they're sort of starting to negotiate terms, and William Wallace says his own terms, which is basically get the hell out of Scotland. Oh, but first, your commander should come over and put his head between his knees and kiss his own ass.
Yeah. Doesn't he also say that they have to stop at every house?
Stop at every house and apologize.
And apologize. Yeah.
So he doesn't really expect them to agree to this, and certainly they don't. Mm-hmm. And the lords go, oh, well, great, thanks a lot. I don't think he's really been talked to that way. And Wallace says, here's what you're going to do. You're going to go right away.
Yeah.
And they go, but we'll look like we're retreating. And he says, yeah, and the English will see you. And they go, oh,
yeah,
oh. And he says, take out their archers. I'll meet you in the middle. I think the lords agree to this way too. It's really quick.
It's a fair point.
They're just like, yes, great, okay. Mm-hmm. And so they go off to do it. And now we ride back with the men. William gets rid of his horse, and we all kind of get in line, and the priest is blessing the soldiers, and they kneel down to take the blessing. And the Scottish, after the prayer, one guy steps forward, lifts up that kilt. Then they all step forward screaming and lifting up their kilts and showing their... And I remember when I saw this in the theater with the original cut, there were a lot of penises, and I think including Mel's.
Wow.
And there were a lot of penises. Because they were much closer shots. Now you're really far away from this. I don't know how it looks in 4K, but but the English lord is not pleased with this, and he calls for archers, and they open fire with the archers, and this is a pneumatic arrow cannon or something like that. And the guys jump behind their shields, and those arrows come in, and one arrow goes right in through Mel's shield. And Stephen says,
the lord tells me he can get me out of this mess. But he's pretty sure you're fucked.
But he's pretty sure you're fucked.
Yeah. So good.
It's so weird. I think that's why this movie works so well, Steve, because there are anachronistic moments throughout that still feel organically part of the film. Yeah.
Yeah. And then they survived it, so they scream again, and then they open fire again, and a couple of guys don't get behind their shield so fast.
Right.
One of the tricks you see, and you see, if you really look at it, you see it all the time, which is someone bleeding before the arrow hits them, or someone bleeding. There's ones where someone gets hit by something, and the blood is exploding outside the helmet. You know, that's like they have a blood pack on the weapon or something,
right?
And that's what's exploding. Like, there's so many things like, but it doesn't matter because it happens so fast and it does so well. And then we go, okay, the arrows didn't work. Let's send in those the cavalry, and the cavalry charge in this battle is amazing. Slow build, the slow movement of the cavalry, the use of slow motion. We see that they have these spears, but they're on the ground. And they're going, hold.
Hold!
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 And we have the fast motion as we're coming to. They're called, the nickname for them was hedgehogs, but the real name was, I think it's Schultrans. Mm-hmm. I think the real word is Schultrans, which actually comes from the Viking shield walls. And as far as I could tell, William Wallace is the first person to add these long spears.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's accurate, but it's a lot of people say that he was the first person to fight heavy cavalry in this way, which is a really, really big deal. Mm-hmm. And there's that fast motion shot of them coming in, and then, and the hold, hold, hold. It's such a great tension build.
It is.
Until the last possible second, and they lift up those spears and they wipe out those horses. A lot of mechanical horses. That's the big, really nasty looking falls are mechanical horses. So they're not really killing a lot of horses. But man, it is so intense. Mm-hmm. And now the Lord is shook.
Yeah.
And he says, send the infantry. You lead them.
Yeah, right.
And now we get the big charge. William Wallace and all the Scots scream and charge and run full speed at him. And there are a lot of continuity errors. I think apparently Wallace is holding a hammer, and then he's got the sword, and then he's got nothing, and then he's got the hammer. It doesn't matter. People who point out continuity errors as signs of bad filmmaking, those are not filmmakers.
Yeah, right. Agreed.
Continuity's hard.
Yeah.
It's like, yes, we don't want to have them, But the movie, the scene is great. Yeah. Nobody, you only see that if you watch that scene five times.
Exactly. And the thing is, this scene, this war scene is one of the best battle scenes
ever.
Ever on film at this from this time period.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic battle scene.
It is brutal and it is fast and there are great moves within it. And the Scottish are, because I don't think barely any Scots get killed.
Right.
They wipe them out.
Yeah.
It is absolutely smashed heads and legs taken off and slit throats and crotch shots and
Knives in the eye.
It is just brutal, including Hamish's dad loses a hand.
Yeah.
But keeps fighting.
He does, of course.
That guy is, look.
He's a Scottish.
He's tough, man.
He's tough, man.
Yeah. And now the Lord's really starting to panic.
Yeah.
And then over the hill come the Lords, the cavalry come in, and they charge and wipe out the archers, and that is going to, and the retreat gets called, and this is we've won.
Yeah,
you know,
right,
we've won this unbelievable battle. And Mel looks around at the battlefield, and there is a primal scream.
Yeah. Like,
where he lifts up that sword and drives it into the ground. And I think we feel that.
Oh, yeah.
I think this is so powerful. Yeah. Between the horse, surviving the archers, surviving the horse charge, then the hand-to-hand battle that is so brutal. When Mel screams, we're like, yeah!
Yeah.
I mean, you feel it. It is amazing.
I still remember seeing it the first time from that moment, because the battle was so insane that when it's over, yes, that's the first thing you do is like feel that desire to yell, primal yell.
And he lives up that big fucking sword and drives it in the ground, and it goes back and forth. And that is an exclamation point, a period on the end of this sentence.
Right.
And I think this is really the halfway point in the movie.
Yeah.
And as this, at the climax, at the height of William Wallace's power, is a good time for us to end part one, but not before.
Yes.
We maybe point out one more inaccuracy.
For this episode.
For this episode, which is that this isn't known historically as the Battle of Stirling.
Nope.
What is it known as, John?
The Battle of Stirling Bridge.
Why would you call it the Battle of Stirling Bridge? There's no bridge in this battle.
Because there's actually a bridge in the real battle that this is supposedly based on, which was the separation between the lower Highland, the lower areas of Scotland and the Highland areas.
Yeah.
You had to cross the bridge, and you could only go over two at a time. It was a wooden bridge. Imagine 10,000 soldiers, British soldiers, on one side having to go over two at a time over that bridge in order to attack the Scottish there in the Highlands.
And so what they did was they let some get across.
Yes, they let a quarter or a third of the army get across.
Right. Ambush them.
Yep.
They had undermined the bridge so it wasn't as strong.
Right.
And right when they had gotten a third across, they destroyed the bridge, wiped out the third, and this gave them the advantage to win the battle.
Absolutely.
Again, totally brilliant strategy.
Right, but not cinematically.
Yeah, and the spears that they used to create these hedgehogs, the Schiltrons or whatever the name is, those were actually really used far more at the Battle of Falkirk, not at this battle, because this didn't have the big cavalry charge because of that bridge.
Exactly.
And so, and this is like an interesting one of where I think this battle is totally amazing.
Oh, it's phenomenal.
It's not accurate,
right?
But I'm okay with it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the what they did with the bridge shows William Wallace's brilliance, the real William Wallace's brilliance in a different way.
Yeah.
But this scene is amazing.
And also, to be a little more historically accurate, some of the British soldiers tried to run away through the water, but because their armor is so heavy, they drowned.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So many of them drowned trying to run away through the water after the bridge went down, and to no avail, obviously, because their armor was so heavy. Yeah. But yes, Steve, once again, this is the camera angle is at a tilt, and it's an interesting way to shoot from below above Mel Gibson when he slams that sword in. It's such an interesting angle to shoot it at. And all of it. But I also think this is a great display of what battle really was like when you see all these bodies strewn across the fields. This is the price. This is the cost.
It is so brutal.
Yeah.
So that's what we think of the first half of Mel Gibson's Braveheart. Of course, we always want to hear what you think. Please visit us on our Facebook page. Do a search for The Cinephiles. Subscribe to us on iTunes or YouTube. If you're on an Android phone, you can use Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, a whole bunch of places to hear our show. Please leave reviews on iTunes. They really do help. They kind of fallen off lately. So if you're new to the show and haven't left us a review, we really would appreciate it. Mm-hmm. If you want to support the show, like so many people did who picked Braveheart, you can do so at patreon.com/thecinephiles. We just recorded a Cinephile Shorts, which would be up here in the next day or two. Mm-hmm. And so those, you only need to pledge $3 to listen to us talk about other topics outside of the films on Cinephile Shorts, $5 to pick a topic for the shorts. And if you want to reach me, you can do so at SR Morris on Twitter or SR Morris 1 on Instagram.
Yeah.
John, where can they reach you?
You can reach me at The Roca Says on Twitter and on Instagram. And what Steve says is absolutely accurate. For those of you who don't know how the algorithm works on iTunes or other podcast providers, you leaving a comment and leaving a rating puts us up higher in visibility so that other people will discover it and find it and become fans of the Cinephiles. We've been building slowly but surely over the last year, through this whole year. Our listenership has grown thanks to the efforts from all y'all to talk about the show, promote the show, tag us in when people are questioning on Twitter what podcast should people be into. All of the work you guys have done as our fans has been incredible. We want to keep it going more and more. And I will throw this out there. And Steve doesn't know I'm going to do this, but I'm throwing this out there and seeing maybe if there are any of you all who know a network, that like a big main network that we might be perfect for, let us know. DM us, tweet at us, let us know, and we will reach out to see if we can get on. Because we want to get on. We want to get bigger and bigger and bigger as this right. thing grows. And being on a bigger network with higher listenership will give us a better opportunity to keep this thing growing.
Yep. 100%. I didn't know you were going to say that, but I totally agree. And I think that is it for this week. We will see you next time for part 2 of Braveheart on The Cinephiles.